This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
Welcome to episode 111 of Literary Disco, Barry Child. Last month, America lost one of its great playwrights. Sam Shepard passed away at the age of 73. And here at the Disco, we decided to go back and read one of his plays, and we settled on the play that really put him on the map, Barry Child, which premiered in 1978 and won the Pulitzer in 1979. I am actor and filmmaker Ryder Strong. Joining me, as always, are essayist and radio personality Julia Pistel and novelist and critic Todd Goldberg. Hey, guys.
Hello.
Hey, it's nice to see you guys.
You too.
Julia, do you have any news for us about anything coming up in your life that you want to talk to us about?
Well, I went to Australia. Thank you so much for asking, Todd.
Look, I just wanted to talk to the audience for just a second about something, a great deception that's going on.
Well, audience, as you know, I am going to be having a baby, and we already talked about that because I got some really nice listener messages, so thank you all so much, on my Twitter, which I never go on. So I promise I will go on and respond someday.
And there's even a Goodreads list for books for Julia's child.
I know. Yeah, it's so great. I will tell you guys that Todd thinks that he can outsmart me into telling him or revealing the sex of my child, which I know and he doesn't, which is not a position he likes to be in.
To be clear, Ryder doesn't know either. It's not you just kept it from me.
But I'm going to sit here smugly and pretend I know.
This is between you and me, Todd.
You're the one that's still trying to like get her to say. I think I have a pretty clear idea.
Ryder has expressed equal convictions on both sides. So
that's true. I started out. Hey, look, I got a 50-50 chance. So now I can. Just
now you have 100% chance, right? Because you've been equivocating so much.
It's like from the Trump playbook, right? I said it one way, and then I said it the other way, so I win either way.
Yeah. Ryder Strong, the Trump of literary podcasting.
Oh boy!
No, I've settled now. I'm convinced now, and I'm convinced mostly by what Todd said earlier off the air. We don't need to go into.
No,
but
why don't you guys take your guesses? Go ahead.
I just want to say that I don't feel like, Julia, that you and your husband Greg need to reveal to the American populace anything personal about your child, the sex that it's going to be, any of that. I just want to know.
No, what you want is to not have me know anything you don't know. That's hurting you.
That is hurting me.
Yeah. But as Greg said, whatever it starts out as, it could change its mind later. So whatever. It's not really that important information.
But hold on. But regardless, I mean, I understand the whole, like, don't want to gender the kid beforehand argument, of course. But doesn't this mean you end up spending or getting a bunch of crap you're not going to use or need?
Ooh.
Because you end up getting doubles of stuff, like people give you, because that's what happens. Like if you say you don't have the gender, like some people will give you like a pink this and a blue that, and then you have to like
then I will either
or keep them both, or
I will either keep both of it or I will return it for store credit like a great American.
All right. Store credit. And buy coffee.
That's what Wendy Duren would do.
Yes, that is exactly what my wife would do. You are correct.
You know what?
I think this speaks to a larger thing, is that instead of, revealing the gender of your child, is just saying, look, just send me presents. Like, send me cake and
yeah,
coffee.
Focus on me. Yeah.
Focus on me. Greg would like a new first-person shooter game. You know, any of that stuff.
That was wildly incorrect, but sure.
I was gonna say, I don't really see Greg playing first-person shooter games.
Greg plays these, like, beautiful fantasy games that no one's ever heard of, and he's like, the design is so amazing. That's what... But I mean, I think, you know, like it is, it does get really focused on gifts, and I'm the one who brought it up off the air, but you know, it's more than that. It's people like creating expectations already. Like, I mean, I remember when my niece was late, you know, she was born a couple weeks late, as like 50% of all babies are. Someone said like, oh, she's gonna make boys wait for her. And I was just like, nope. And that is what happens. So like the longer that we can fend that kind of talk off, the better.
All right.
I was going to say, it's going to be unavoidable once they're born.
I support
then it's
that.
Just
I mean, I support that.
The onslaught.
I support that just, you know, generally, but I want to know.
Yeah. This is, listeners, you must know, this is a battle of wills. And this is about
Did you
someone...
say it's a battle for my son, Will?
This is about Todd thinking he can outsmart me, but he can't.
All right, listen.
I will be very excited to tell you the real answer.
I'm going
to
tell you one thing that I told Julia before we were on the air, which is that she posted something on the internet about how she and her husband, Greg, were having a conversation about, like, imagining the conversations they're going to have with their child when that child is a little older. And Greg imagined a conversation where he said to the child, something along the lines of, why did you burn down that house? Why are you playing with matches? And my theory is that the majority of serial arsonists are men, and therefore Julia and Greg were having a boy.
Well, let your weird analysis stand, because Greg made one joke about having an arsonist.
I'm just saying. Criminal
readers,
minded. That's what I am.
Readers/listeners, you're welcome also to make your guesses or attempt to outsmart me. You can be included in this situation.
Based on Julia's social media, attempt to outsmart her.
Okay, well, there's no way to make a smooth transition to a very depressing play called Buried Child out of this conversation.
No, it really isn't.
There's just no way to do it, so we're just going to jump right in.
Yeah, I'm imagining several, and they're all bad.
They're all bad.
So let's talk about Sam Shepard for a second, because we had an interesting moment before we went to air where we were talking about what we do know about Sam Shepard, and Todd assumed that he was from Kentucky or the South somewhere because of the whole cowboy boot wearing tough guy image of Sam Shepard. And my understanding was that he was from Southern California, and it turns out he was born in Illinois, I think,
right.
And then grew up in Southern California and became an actor first and then a playwright. He began writing more sort of absurdist stuff in New York in the 60s and 70s. And this play, Buried Child, really catapulted him to the world stage and became a huge success, winning the Pulitzer. And he went on to be nominated for an Academy Award in 1984 for his performance in The Right Stuff, a movie I still have never seen, actually, but it's supposed to be a classic about astronauts. So he's a really an accomplished playwright. And I mean, the guy wrote so many plays. Like, when we first brought this up, there, you know, our options were sort of limitless as to where and at what point in his career we could have. And he's I think, you know, Buried Child, and we can talk about this when we get into the text, but I think it's sort of there's like a cliche version of Sam Shepard. And I think that this fits a lot of those, in that it's, you know, a family with secrets and characters with interesting names, mm-hmm. like Dodge. And, you know, there's a sort of like Faulknerian American tragedy, lots of alcoholism, pill popping, lots of angry men, abused women. But then it seems, and I haven't read a whole lot of Sam Shepard, but it seems like he wrote a lot of different types of plays. And like I said, like, I guess early on in his career, and I haven't read any of these, but he wrote really sort of abstract, more absurdist stuff, comedic stuff. And then his later career, it was sort of up for grabs. Like, he's very hard to pin down. But I think as far as his reputation, he is known as a sort of Western, very gritty American, all American, old school guy voice. Is that a good way to put it?
Yeah, I mean, I think I think this play put him on the map nationally, but you know, it's a play like True West where it's just two men in a house. One of them is a writer that also made him sort of iconic for the artistic class as well. But you know, he speaks to that kind of the thing we've talked about 1,000 times on this show, that cliche of the tough man of the West, you know, mm-hmm. who also, you know, can go home and paint after he gets into a fight in a bar or whatever it might be. But you know, he was, I think, in his real life, I mean, this is a Renaissance man. He wrote, he acted. I think he also was a painter, if I remember correctly. I think he might have done some painting. But he also wrote fiction. I mean, he had a novel as well. He did a little bit of everything. And I don't know if, I know, Ryder, you read it because we talked about it before. But he also, you know, he had this life of cultivated friendships with people from different parts of the art world. So apparently he and Patti Smith were great friends, and she wrote this wonderful sad essay in The New Yorker shortly after his death. You know, the thing about Sam Shepard also is that when I read certain kinds of books, I imagine Sam Shepard as the narrator. You know, any book where the main character wears like a denim shirt open to 3 buttons too far and his skin is cragged red and, you know, you know, basically a Richard Ford, Rick Bass, Barry Hanna character. I always imagine them as Sam Shepard. And I think, in fact, Sam Shepard might have adapted a Richard Ford book. I think he wrote Bright Angel, which is an adaptation of 3 Richard Ford short stories into a not very good movie. I'm going to check that right now. But, you know, so he was an icon.
Wow.
Did a little bit of everything. What did you know about him, Julia, while I look at Bright Angel?
Well, this is actually interesting because I see a lot of plays. It's a big part of my life. But I realized when we read this, I had never read or seen anything about him. Amazing. I have never, this was my absolute first relationship with an actual work. I mean, I had obviously heard of him, and actually it's funny because we've been doing in the winter an improv format where we get a suggestion of a famous playwright. And I specifically remember someone was like, what's a famous playwright? And someone said Sam Shepard. And as we often do, we'll just kick it right back to the audience. Like, okay, what's he all about? When you think of Sam Shepard, what do you think of? And the person who had said it was like, I don't know. Like, they were like, I can't name one play. I don't know. I just know it's the name of a playwright. Right. So that was essentially where I stood.
Well, that's really interesting to me. I think that speaks to a kind of a generational divide a little bit, because I do feel like he was most popular in the 80s and 90s.
For sure.
He really dominated American stage, and also like his style, like his approach to theater, like, you know, the sort of, you know, like what we experience in Barry Child, which is just like a house set, you know, with like mm-hmm. 2 floors, and it's like a living room with a flickering TV, and everything takes place in the course of like one night with a family drinking too much. That approach to like American theater is very much like it dominated in the late 70s mm-hmm. and through the mid 90s, and is now kind of feels a little cliched. You know, it feels like something we've seen. I think August Osage County, which he acted in the film version of, is sort of like the last gasp of that type of play. And it felt like a callback even when it premiered 10 years ago, however long it came out. That felt like an old school play. So I feel like plays have really moved in different directions since you've been going to plays, Julia, you know?
Yeah, that's certainly true in terms of like original works. But like, I mean, when I read this, I saw the Long Day's Journey Into Night production that Philip Seymour Hoffman starred in, which was amazing. And it's so similar. I mean, it's the same exact thing.
Except it's 4 hours long and nothing happens, but people yell at each other.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, the other thing about Shepard is that in the last 20 years, he hadn't written he didn't write as many plays in the last 20 years as he did in the 70s and the 80s.
Yeah.
You know, his output was far less. And, of course, he had Lou Gehrig's disease the last several years of his life, so he wasn't doing new stuff. But I don't know if this is the case for both of you, but the version of Buried Child I purchased and read is actually a updated version from the original one that he rewrote parts of Buried Child in 2006.
Oh no, I don't have that version.
Yes,
we'll have to compare.
Acting version.
Yeah, to make some of the characters a bit more rich and to update it a little bit.
We'll have to get into what the differences are then.
There's a note about it. Yeah.
So just so I'm clear, so he did not write Bright Angel, but he did portray the narrator of all these Richard Ford stories as an adult in these. So maybe my vision of him as being that guy is because he played that guy in Bright Angel. But he did not write or direct. He just starred in it.
Mm-hmm. I've seen a few productions of Sam Shepard plays. The most notable was and this is like one of the most formative theater-going experiences of my life, is I saw Philip Seymour Hoffman and John C. Reilly do True West in
New York.
And I wish I had spent the whatever thousands of dollars I would have needed to go the next night, because they alternated roles every night.
Oh my God.
Oh, wow.
Which is the way that True West it wasn't the way it was originally produced, but that kind of became the most sort of actory way to do it, was that two actors would learn both parts and every night switch roles. And what was so crazy to me is that I saw it with Philip Seymour Hoffman as the sort of the more conservative writerly brother and John C. Reilly as the, the more rebellious brother.
Mm.
I can't imagine it being the other way around after seeing it. Do you know what I mean? Like, I've talked to people who saw it the opposite way, and they feel the same way. And then I talked to people who saw it both ways, and they were like, it was the most amazing experience of my life. You know, like, so, yeah, I mean, when was that? That had to have been in 2000 or 99. So I was 20. It had a huge impact on me. It's just such an amazing play. Like, I actually want to reread it because it's in the same collection of plays that I got to read Buried Child, and I want to reread it. But you know, like, it was just a defining moment for me. It was like, oh, this is what theater can do. This is what good actors can do, and good writing, and it was mind-boggling. It was so beautiful.
I always imagine when you talk about you and Shiloh writing scripts and stuff together, that it's like True West.
Yeah. Well, our first short film, Irish Twins, owes such a debt to True West. Like, it is, you know, it's about two brothers and fighting and drinking. It's like so clearly like, and I hadn't really thought about that until I popped open this book and started thinking about Sam Shepard again. I was like, oh my God, like 6 years or 7 years after I'd seen that play, I went and made a short film that was so clearly like a short version of a lot of the same issues that True West wrestles with. And God, I love that play. There's a moment in that play where I think it's between scenes, like it's maybe it's the end of an act break or whatever, where the character, I think his name is Lee, he's the like the swaggering criminal brother, makes like he tells his brother, the writerly nerdy one, like you couldn't steal a toaster.
Right.
And then the next scene opens and he's stolen toasters from all the neighbors. And so the play comes up, and it's not a changing set. It's just a living room, or a kitchen / living room. Like, you know, it's just a house. And I was seeing it at the production I saw was in the round. So it's like you're basically the whole audience is not in the round completely. It was Circle in the Square Theater, I think. So you're mostly like the audience is like looking at each other a lot of it. So you're looking down on this living room set, and we all notice the smell of toast. And
it's
because
that's awesome.
He's toasty in all these different toasters that he's stolen. And so the scene over, and I just remember being like, what is that smell? Oh my God, why do I smell toast? And it's like the next morning after he spent the night stealing all these toasters, and now he's making toast to just gonna piss his brother off. And it's like it's like one of those things that you're like, right, that's what theater can do. You can smell the toast.
Mm-hmm.
And what that does is it like physically brings you into this this satisfaction that this character is feeling, like, to prove to his brother, like, I can steal shit too. Like, I can be just as rebellious as you. And it's like, it was such a wonderful thing. You're like, yeah, like, you could watch a movie where that happens, but it's not going to be the same as if you're sitting in the theater smelling that toast. And for the rest of the scene, you're smelling the way that scene started. It's just like, so yeah, that's theater. It's so cool.
That's awesome.
And, you know, for listeners that have never seen True West, there's a really good version with Gary Sinise and John Malkovich that you can watch online.
I bet that's amazing.
Yeah, I don't remember. I think it might have been on PBS or something initially. I remember watching it on TV. But John Malkovich is really good in it. I mean, John Malkovich is good in most things.
So speaking, speaking of Gary Sinise, I'm looking at this note. Gary Sinise was also in Buried Child, and it was his work on the play that made Sam Shepard change a lot of stuff. So that's pretty interesting. I guess Gary Sinise is total Sam Shepard head, or at least some kind of muse.
You can imagine Gary Sinise in almost every role of
Sam Shepard. Yeah, I know. It doesn't say who he played.
He defines that sort of guy. Like, that denim-wearing... three-button guy, three-unbuttoned buttons guy that Todd was describing. Like, Gary Sinise is such that guy.
Right. That's funny. I liked him in... Did you guys ever see Forrest Gump?
Okay. All right. Let's get back to the play. Let's get back to the play.
Please.
He was Lieutenant Dan.
Okay. Also, I'm noticing it's Gary Sinise that directed this, so that's pretty interesting.
All right. So, Barry Child. I think we've already kind of set the stage a little bit. It's incredible, like... how descriptive he is of his set. I don't like, you know, not all playwrights do that. In fact, often they don't even bother to describe where you are and leave that up. But he is so specific. It's very cinematic. It's describing the frayed carpet and the way the sofa looks and the textures. He describes what everybody's wearing. So it has like this quality to it that, on the page, I think that's part of why you can imagine Gary Sinise and a lot of his roles. It's like there's a very clear stylistic clothing choices, and you know, there's such character, such a defined cultural archetypes that he's playing with throughout this play, and it seems like all his plays. And I wonder how much they will translate into different productions. Like, I would love to see like three different productions of Buried Child and see if they stick to the sort of letter of the law of Sam Shepard's writing, or if, you know, Shelley's rabbit fur coat becomes something different in a different version. But yeah, it's very, very specific. I've already kind of said this, but, and I'm curious what you guys think, especially you, Julia, like, because there is such a defined Sam Shepard-ness, or I couldn't help but feel like I knew where this play was going. I knew it, you know, and I appreciate it because I can sort of take my brain away and go like, oh, well, it was written in 1979 when this type of play didn't feel cliche, but it did strike me as kind of like, oh, I got it from like the second page of the play. I was like, I know where all of this is going to go. And it was great. It's very, very well written. But how did you feel about that, Julia? Did you have any sense of that?
Yeah. I mean, well, like you, Ryder, I really love Faulkner. So I was like, ding, ding, ding. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And in terms of like relationships and family secrets and plots like that, I mean, I felt like I was on solid ground. But right. I think, especially just reading it and not seeing it, what was really interesting about this style to me is I was like, what I was feeling is this is both super realism and so surreal at the same time.
Yeah. Very strange.
And
that
balance was really captivating. So, you know, this repetition of like, oh, I found all this corn. There's corn everywhere. Too. There's no corn. Yes, there is corn. No, there isn't. And it's about something so, you know, like literally in the ground, literally physical. It does not seem like something you could argue about whether or not there is corn outside. That it was it was unique to me in that way. You know, it was neither so grounded in realism that I felt like I could predict or like write every line, and certainly not cliche, but it was also surreal in a way that I was kept off balance. So yeah, I didn't feel like, oh, this is like, you know, something I've seen a million times. Rather, it felt like something that I was like seeing in some kind of mirror. You know, like I've seen other things that I know came after this or before it or in different forms. Mm-hmm. But I didn't feel a sense of like I knew where it was going, especially with the ominous title Buried Child. You know, I was really into the title, which is not something we ever talk about, but it just
which is weird.
Yeah.
You never do talk about titles.
Well, usually they're just kind of either like super vague or, you know, really bad. So why talk about them? But, you know,
it's like giving something a name, you know, like why would you give something a name?
To that point, the introduction to the edition I have was written by Richard Gilman, and he talks about titles and names a lot. And listen to what he has to say. Most of his titles float, bob up and down from the plays on shorter or longer strings. They appear as aggressions, put-ons, or parodies, but almost never as traditional titles in some direct or logical connection to the works. They seem crazily theatrical in themselves. They scare you or break you up before the curtain has even risen. And here he lists them, or some of them. Dog, Killer's Head, 4-H Club, The Holy Ghostly, Cowboy Mouth, Shaved Splits, 1400,000, Back Bog Beast Bait, The Tooth of Crime, Blue Bitch, Action, The Mad Dog Blues, Angel City, Geography of a Horse Dreamer, Operation Sidewinder, Curse of the Starving Class, Forensic and the Navigators, Icarus's Mother. And then he says, I don't know if it has been pointed out how these titles resemble the names of rock groups or pieces of graffiti or certain writings on t-shirts. They don't denote finished discrete dramas as much as a continuing action, a calling of attention. They're less identifications than announcements. I think that's so true. It's really interesting.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Yeah, because with Buried Child, I mean, a title, especially on a play where you're sitting there with a playbill on your lap, a title is a kind of promise or mystery, and this title resonates through so many of the characters and so many, you know, so many of the symbols that it is, you're kind of constantly referring back to it in a way that is not true of most other works or plays that I've seen. I found it to be a surreal experience based in gritty American detail, which didn't really surprise me.
You know, the surrealism for me, I read this play in college at some point, but I didn't really remember it very well. But what I did recall is that at the beginning of the play, there's the main character at the beginning is a character named Dodge, who is in his 70s and quite ill and is on a couch. And it becomes apparent that he is both drunk and also probably suffering from a bit of dementia. And at first, what the surrealism represented to me was Dodge's view of the world, the deteriorating view that Dodge had of the world because of his mental faculties leaving him. But then as other characters come into the story, come onto the stage, and you recognize, particularly when Dodge is asleep or off stage, that everyone is viewing the world in a skewed way, that it's not just Dodge's view that is unreliable, it's everyone's view that is unreliable. And then I realized, oh gosh, this is a thing that I've not really seen before, really portrayed, where you're bouncing back and forth from surrealism to hyperrealism. And then of course it's an allegory simply for the destruction of the nuclear family, the changing way the American dream is both attained and envisioned, what it means to have been a hero, and what heroism means at different times in different people's lives. I mean, there's a lot of shit that Sam Shepard puts into one little play. And I don't know if he could do all of that without it being also a little surreal and madcap. There's a bit of this where it's a little Thurbery, where people are like running in and out, and there's a guy with a missing leg, and people are waving the leg, and I mean, it gets a little zany at one point late in the play.
It does. And it seems like it would be really hard to I mean, in a way, that's kind of what's exciting about reading this. Like, I'm sitting here thinking, like, as a director or as an actor, this is a difficult play. You know, it's like, it's not easy because you could really throw things out of balance easily and make the audience, like, inappropriately, like, think this is hysterical. Mm-hmm. Or maybe entirely appropriately think this is hysterical. I don't know. Like, you could go so many different ways with this, which is what makes it a very rich text. I think it's brilliant. I loved it. And I think, like, Julia, what your point, like, the surrealism really sells it for me, because it's just, if this had just stayed in this sort of, like, Tennessee Williams realism, like, world, I would feel like, oh, I've seen this a million times. I know where this is going. But, like, the images, even though I didn't see them, just reading them, the images linger with me. And the weird physical objects that are brought on stage, the carrots, the corn husks, and the violence that isn't really that violent, but is very mm-hmm. disturbing. There's a very sort of aggressive scene between a guy and a female character that is just, like, disturbing. And it's like, it's not even violent, but it's incredibly violent, and it's non-violence, and it's sexual nature. And it's again, it's a very surreal moment, but you know exactly what's going on, and it's mm-hmm. just awful. Even that moment, I feel like has been stolen time and time again by other movies. And so it's nice to read something like this and go, like, oh, this is, like, one of those sort of founding documents of American theater. And it holds up.
We should mention the central conceit. I mean, we can give out some spoilers because this play has been out since 1976 mm-hmm. or whatever. You know, that the buried child in question, and we don't know really until the very end if it's true or not, but that this family had a child that they killed and buried in their backyard. And you don't know, as the play is going on, whether that is the idea of a child, whether that is the memory of another son who died, if it is a metaphor for a thousand different things, but it is the family secret. And that's the Tennessee Williams part, mm-hmm. that gothic concrete stuff of weird backwoods life that can happen where, well, maybe you have a baby and you kill it and no one knows because there's no one around. You gave birth at home. You know, all that stuff that we've been reading about for 1,000 years. And I think Shepherd plays with that. He plays with this notion of, you know, what happens in this house stays in this house. We are solid country people and we do what we want to do. We grow our own corn. We get our own potatoes and carrots. But when we enter this play, the land has grown fallow around their house. No vegetables are growing anymore. The patriarch of the family is dying on the sofa. The matriarch of the family is going on about the loss of God in society and is dressed in all black and is going to church, she says. But you don't know if she's going to church or she's going to a funeral. It's not really clear. So there's all this stuff going on, but the larger issue is that all the characters that then come into the play, and it's the sons of Dodge and his wife Haley, and then a grandson and the grandson's girlfriend, all of them are circling around this one central question of, is there actually a child buried in the backyard?
Yeah.
And that metaphor isn't solved really until the very end of the play itself. So there's this madcap stuff that goes on. There's this obviously very serious stuff that goes on. And sometimes you laugh because you hope that what it is they're talking about is not true, because then it's the most disgusting thing you've ever read.
I think you can
kill and bury someone in the backyard, but you can't kill and bury a kid. You know,
well, I think, like, the question that you know, the question that you're asking yourself, like you said, is there a buried child in the backyard, or are they using this? Are they talking about this metaphorically, or is this for real? Also, like, there's something threatening the corporeality of all of the characters. There's like this weird sense that like people might not actually be there, that people might look at each other and not see each other for who they really are. And like, and then of course there's one character who has lost a leg and he seems completely incapable of existing without his leg attached to him, his wooden leg attached to him. And then like some characters are off stage, like is it Hallie or Haley, do you think?
I don't know.
Anyway. I was thinking Haley. So Haley's like disembodied for like the entire first half of the play. She's just a voice. And like, and then, you know, I don't know. It's like you're actually questioning the reality of who, it, like people's bodies on stage. And the character of Shelley, so the main drama of the play is that this grandson who has been gone for 6 years shows up with a girlfriend. And she's from Los Angeles. And I don't think that's a coincidence either. I think that, you know, the fact that she comes from a place without roots and that doesn't have a sort of like history the way that this family has, this like deep, you know, American generational history with the place and the land. And she comes in and she's all like excited to meet this Norman Rockwell painting family. And then is quickly drawn into this nightmare. You know, like there's so much of like them not recognizing the son, like his physical existence is like sort of ignored by half of them.
It's weird.
It's really weird. And it's like, you know, like you said, you keep asking yourself like, okay, these people are all delusional. Or are they intentionally ignoring this kid? And then like the question of this other son, Ansel, did you guys quite get whether he really existed or not, or what the story was of him?
I think
So Ansel, he was real.
He was real.
No one else referred to him except for Haley.
Yeah,
but that wasn't the buried child.
No,
the other boys, the Tilden or whatever his name is, he talks about Ansel. So they talk about, so Ansel dies in weird circumstances in a hotel room. But he was the local hero. He was the sports star, and he could do anything. He was, I mean, he's the cliche of the fair-haired
the
boy.
The all-American hero, right.
Yeah, and so the mother purportedly leaves the house to go talk to the priest about getting a sculpture of the son put in the town square, basically. But it also becomes clear that maybe the mom is having an affair with the priest. I mean, there's all kinds of weird stuff that's
going she's
on.
Definitely having an affair with the priest.
Yeah.
No doubt about that.
But the son is real, I believe, because he also stands for that hope of the American West, of this great star. And the monument they're going to build to Ansel is a monument of him playing basketball while holding a shotgun.
Perfect. Yeah, I mean, they're so... The sons, you know, they're all something close to the American dream with all something grotesque or wounded about them. So, I mean, there could have been a lot. There are an unlimited number of sons. To go back to Shelley for a second, I mean, what you're saying, Ryder, is so interesting because... So, you know, her entrance into the play is she's obviously a stand-in for the entire, you know, LA or West Coast or whatever audience of like, oh my God, this is so nostalgic. This is so cute. Let me spend an hour or two in this zone. And then she just tries to backtrack out and she's trapped. And I just love that idea that she's so directly speaking for the audience. She's on stage for maybe 5 minutes before she's just like, nope, this is creepy. I would like to leave. Almost literally. And that is almost the line. So that's really
and
wonderful.
And then she's like, then they're like, can you deal with this corn? And she's like, fine, I'll just be over here with the corn. Or the carrots, I mean. It's like, I'd just be over here peeling carrots. I don't want to have to deal with any human beings. It's amazing. She's such an interesting character.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. Well, good play. I mean, I don't know if I have more to say about it because it is so simple in its own way. And I think, you know, it's one of those things where you want it to wash over you rather than pull every line apart.
Yeah. And I think that I would really like to see it. I would love to see this played on the stage. So we should ask you, Ryder, the difference between the two versions that we read. So the version that Julia and I read, there is... According to the front note from Sam Shepard, there is a heightened sense of the weird sexual attraction between Dodge and his grandson's girlfriend, Shelley. Is that
apparent? That's not in there at all.
Oh yeah, it's deep.
I mean, he teases her and like really humiliates her, there's not really that much. I don't think it's very like flirty.
He essentially. At first, and Julia, you can tell me if you thought this was different. Mm-hmm. He begins to confuse her initially with his wife.
Oh yeah, there's none of that.
Yeah.
So there's a sort of a mirroring going on with Shelley now versus Haley or Hallie or whatever, however you pronounce her name when they were young and in love. So there's an absolute weird sort of sexual thing going on with Dodge. It's not reciprocated on Shelley's part. It should be noted.
Yeah.
And then there's also Shepherd heightened Vince. Vince is the grandson. Heightened Vince's consequences and role in the story so that Vince is the one who ends up putting a lot of things together at the end of the play.
Good, so, because Vince is such a bad character in this version of
the
play.
So,
he's weakest part of the play for me.
Here's the Sam Shepherd quote. So, here we go. But most important, the character Vince seemed to be hanging in the wind without real purpose. Even though a core truth of this character is his aimlessness and passivity, there seemed to be no point in allowing him to be completely outside the play, almost in the predicament of a narrator. So I began to try to find ways to bring him around to see the light, as it were, without turning him into some kind of hero or Sherlock Holmes. Finally, the language began to settle in and take hold. And this is really interesting. I did want to talk about this. There were fewer gaps between the actors, the characters, and the words. I'm very grateful for having had the opportunity to do this work. It's now a better play. So for Sam Shepard to have written this play that launched his career and won a Pulitzer Prize, go back almost 30 years later and say, nope, this was bad. Let me just make some major changes. It is so commendable, you know, especially for a playwright who could do whatever he wanted. He could have even rewritten a totally different version of this play, fixing the problems. But to, like, take that risk on your own text based on the influence of another artist or set of artists, in this case, Gary Sinise and the actors who are in this production, that's really cool and wonderful and something really exciting.
I think speaks to the collaborative nature of theater in general.
Yeah.
Like, I love that. You know, I love that he still maintained that. And also, I mean, I guess I'm not surprised because he was so prolific. Like, you look at the amount of plays the guy wrote. He never stopped. And it doesn't seem like he ever, like, rested on his laurels or felt like he was done as an artist. And I think that's, you know, God, I really hope I'm always like that.
Yeah.
No matter how much success.
The one last thing, which makes me now want to read the previous version, which is in the same preface, is he says, when Gary Sinise started work on the Steppenwolf production in Chicago in 1995, enough time had elapsed for me to clearly see the holes in the play. This insight was also heightened by Gary's instinct to push the characters and situation into an almost burlesque territory, which you really see in the kind of madcap stuff that begins to happen in the middle of it as things get crazier and crazier and crazier. And I don't think of Shepherd as being a guy who goes for madcap. You know, he goes like, people get crazier. So I got to go back and read the original version.
Cool.
To see the difference.
It's great. I mean, really, the only weakness I felt was the Vince character. Like, when you guys said that they were rewriting, I was hoping that, because it's the most difficult role. Like, you could see an actor just being screwed with that role.
Yeah.
Because he comes back really drunk and doesn't do anything. He just comes back and he's like babbling for two pages and then he like cuts his way in and has a complete turn where he's like turning on Shelley and now he's just going to be part of his family. And there's no reason why. There's no change. He hasn't been there for any revelation. He's just sort of like, you know, absorbed by the house, which is kind of cool, actually, you know, thematically. But as a character, as an actor, I was like, oh, this would be a shitty role to have.
You know, it would be a great role is frickin' Bradley, whose entrance is sneaking on stage and weirdly cutting Dodge's hair.
Yeah.
That's a treat.
As hell.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, actually, I wanted to talk about that for a second. Did you guys feel like that was a Samson reference?
Yes. Of course.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, all right. So that was like my first, like, this is probably going to go way down a rabbit hole that I shouldn't talk about. But
oh, no.
It was like, But I
you were doing so well.
No way anyone on the internet will be angry with you.
Sorry, we're going to wrap this up. But I guess I want to talk about this because I had a, you know, I had like a nice journey with this, and I think there's maybe a point in here, which is that my initial instinct when I, you know, I saw the haircut in or in the play, and I put the play down, and I was like, oh, okay, well that's obviously like a Samson Delilah reference, right? So I was like, look up Samson and Delilah on Wikipedia, and I get the like Wikipedia Delilah entry, and I read like two lines. I'm like, wait, hold on, what am I doing? Like, I've read the Bible. When was the last time I read the Bible? Like, so I like stopped reading Wikipedia, like went over to my shelf where I have my Bible, and I like opened it up, and then I Google searched which verses are the Samson Delilah, you know, Samson verses, and it's like, okay, Judges 16 through 20 or whatever. Then I went and got my Bible, I spent this morning, by the way, because I just read the play this morning. So I got lost in reading Judges 13 through 17, and it was amazing. Like, it was such a fun. And then I'm sitting there like reading about. I mean, by the way, it's like. Like, all of it is in the play. Like, there's so much here that is valuable to reading the play. Like, did you guys know, like, Delilah is, like, the end of Samson. Do you guys know about Samson?
Yeah, she takes away his strength,
right? I don't think I know the play very
well. Okay, dude, it's so crazy. He's married before Delilah. Delilah he's not even married to. Like, Samson, like, it starts with his parents. And you get this whole angel comes to visit his parents. And what they say to his parents, because she's barren, she can't have kids. So the angel of God appears and says, we're going to need you to help us defeat the Philistines, because they're at war with the Philistines. And we're going to need you to deliver Israel from the hands of the Philistines. So don't drink. Stop drinking. Mm-hmm. Don't eat anything unclean. And you'll have a boy who's a Nazirite. And a Nazirite, I was like, what the hell is a fucking Nazirite? And you look up a Nazirite.
Back to Wikipedia.
So then I go back on. I look up. Yep. Exactly. Back to Wikipedia, but just for the definition, because it's an Israelite consecrated to the service of God under vows to abstain from alcohol, let the hair grow, and avoid defilement by contact with corpses.
Yeah.
All right.
Don't fuck corpses.
No.
Don't
but
touch
think about
them
Barry
at all.
Child. There's a dead kid in the yard. Like, it's all there. So then I go back and I'm reading Samson, and like, this is the craziest fucking story. Like, it just makes you realize how whack the Bible is. Like, so so the angel comes and the guy's wife, he visits the guy's wife and says, you're going to have this kid, Samson, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, the guy's husband or the wife's husband comes home, and he's like, I don't believe you. I don't think this was an angel. So then they start a fire and they sacrifice the angel, and the angel burns, and they realize like, oh, it was an angel. Oh my God, we pissed God off. Let's go forward. But then they're not going to drink. They're not going to cut their hair. They have the kid. And then Samson, it's so surreal. He's like born and he's kind of powerful. And then he runs into a lion. He kills a lion with his bare hands, and honey comes out from the inside of the lion.
That's
it's like
weird.
So trippy. He eats the honey, and then he brings the honey back to his parents, and he makes them eat it. And then he's like, I picked this woman from the Philistines. And the parents are like, you can't just pick a Philistine. Like, they're bad people. But apparently, it was all part of God's plan to have him marry a Philistine so the Philistines
Spoiler
can betray
alert.
Samson. So the Israelites will kill all the Philistines. It's so violent and fucked up and weird. But fundamentally, so then Samson turns to the people and to the Philistines, and he says, look, you got to give me this woman, and if you can figure out this riddle, I'll give you a bunch of clothes. I'll give you 30 linens and like whatever. It's like, you know, he's going to give them a bunch of money and stuff if they can figure out the riddle. And the riddle is nonsense, but it's about him killing this lion. And what they do is they go to his wife and say, get the secret of the riddle. And she nags him. And nags him until Samson tells her the secret. And so this is a quote from the Bible. And because she nagged him on the seventh day, he told her. So then he loses to the Philistines, has to pay them. And he turns on his wife. He like basically gives his wife to his best man because she nagged him. And what he says to them, if you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have found out my riddle.
Ugh.
It's like this complete woman-hating
Gross.
Bullshit. And then he you know, ends up killing all the Philistines. His wife dies. I think he kills her too. It's awful. And then he like, you know, has a jawbone of a donkey that he uses to kill thousands of people. It's so surreal and awesome.
Can I ask a question? Just a technical question. How do they catch the angel to burn it?
Okay, this is...
He offers up. He says, go ahead and have a sacrifice, but burn me if you... You know, it's like to prove the point, basically.
Oh, gotcha. So
dare you interrupt this greatest rider freight train of all time?
I was confused because I thought, well, why doesn't the angel just leave?
All right, you're very behind.
Way at the end. Okay, so way at the end. Now, we've already... So Samson's lived his life. He's, like, killed people with the jawbone of a donkey. Like, that's what? They don't even, like, explain how that is. But then he, like, throws the jawbone around, and then it's like, and that's why it's the jawbone hill. And then he, like, is thirsty, and he's like, God, you got to give me some water. I just killed a bunch of Philistines for you. So then God, like, opens up a river valley, and now it's, like, always known as this real river valley. So it's all, like, this mythological whatever. But then, like, all the way at the end of his, like, story, you get this little Delilah thing where he just falls in love with this woman of Sorek, in the Valley of Sorek, and he comes to her, and again, a woman betrays him because the Philistines go to Delilah, and they're like, tell us the secret of Samson's power. And so she goes to Samson and is like, tell me the secret of your power. How do I bind you? And he says, well, the only way to bind me, and he gives her two false stories, and they're like, you know, you have to be these kinds of bindings, and da-da-da. And each time, he breaks through and turns to Delilah and says, you've lied to me, but he stays with her. And then the third time, again, after she had nagged him with her words day after day and pestered him, he was tired to death. So that's why Samson says, I get my power from my hair. And she cuts his hair in the middle of the night, and he's captured, and the Philistines gain power. And then he destroys their temple because his hair starts to grow back once he's a prisoner, and he's brought in front of all of the Philistines, and he knocks down because he's getting his hair back, and he asks God for the final strength to kill all these people. But anyway, I thought it was amazing. Like, people talk about the story of Samson and Delilah, but I always thought it was like, oh, a guy got a power from his hair and his wife cut it. But it's like, actually, that's the last part of this giant story about a guy being nagged by women. Like, wow. That's what it comes down to.
How,
like,
beautiful.
He is like, this, yeah, isn't it awful?
Wow, I'm so glad that every major world religion is built on that. How exciting.
So, Julia, are you going to tell your child the story of Samson and Delilah? And who in that story will you be focusing on for your child?
I will be focusing on learning to turn a donkey jawbone into a weapon.
Yes, exactly.
That is correct. I no longer need to know.
My meta point that I'd like to make here is get the fuck off Wikipedia. Like, I was so happy. I had, like, such a fun adventures. Like, this was only, like, it's so short. What I read is actually, you know, because the Bible is pretty quick and, like, it's just one sentence and thousands of people die. So, like... I'm just like, that's going to be my new thing, is the second I find a reference in something and I want to look it up, I'm going back to a real book, because you end up having all these weird side adventures and realizations and, like, reference points that you never get otherwise. And, like, it only mildly influenced my understanding of this play, but it just, like, opened up a whole other part of my brain. And I'm so sick of, like, taking the shortcut, which is looking online and letting somebody else tell me what this means, or, like, the meaning of this biblical story or this interpretation. Go to the source. Like, if you can go find the source in your home or at the library or online or on your Kindle, but don't just go for, like, the easy definition, because it's, like, it's so worth it. Like, you end up having so much more fun, and it, like, it's a little more exhausting, but it takes a little bit more time. But, man, like, I'm high from that experience.
And it's super worth it with the Bible too, because, you know, I'm not religious, but everyone should read the Bible because it has influenced everything. So the more that you understand, you know, and can connect things like that, it's really fun and meaningful and brings a lot of richness to your intellectual life. Wow, Ryder, I don't think we can or should come back from that absolute insanity. We just analyzed a whole play and Samson and Delilah.
Let me just say that next week, when we debut Literary Leviticus, that Ryder is going to step back.
Dude, if you know what we could do? We could start just doing, like, Bible little excerpts. Like, we all just read, like, one of these stories, because there's a lot of them and they're all pretty short. We could do, like, one an episode and just, you know, all three of us read a little Bible verse.
What I can tell you is that over the course of the last 5 years, having read all of the Talmud, it gets weirder.
Oh yeah,
it gets weirder.
It's so sexist, and like God is just so villainous. Like he's just lying to everybody and getting these people to turn on these people, and it's really twisted.
Well, thank God it hasn't had any effect on our normal everyday. Oh no, it does every single day.
Oh, okay, that's enough.
All right, everybody, go out and read a Sam Shepard play. He was an American hero. He actually is featured in the Bible.
I wouldn't be surprised if we're going to get a lot of Sam Shepard revivals in the next couple of years. Yeah. So go and see
totally.
If want a place
oh, for sure.
on near you.
For sure. Yeah. And he also was a spaceman. Yeah.